Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Culture Heritage Fund. Helping you discover the Twin Cities, it's Radio K's Real College Podcast. Online and on the air, my name is Matthew Curtis, and this week we are paying tribute to the past in order to move forward. I am joined by the show's producers as we look back on our favorite stories to reflect, learn, and progress. It all starts right now on the Real College Podcast. It's not 1928 anymore. Shows like Amos and Andy, which relied heavily on black stereotypes for laughs, are no longer on the air. But then again, it hardly feels like the 21st century, in Hollywood's portrayal of African Americans, or the opportunities presented to black actors or actresses. New reporter Max Fuller examines why the film industry is still lacking in the diversity department in 2014.
The year is 2014. We have a black president, black secretary of state, Oprah's still black, Flavor Flav's black enough for all of us, and yet I bet you still probably can't name more than five black actors.
All right, Denzel. All
right. Probably
even less black directors and writers. In fact, according to the 2014 Hollywood Diversity Report, only 7.6% of major motion picture writers are black. And only 5% of the directors of major Hollywood films in the last 5 years have been black. Just for some perspective, the NHL, that's right, the National Hockey League, arguably the whitest sport in America next to water polo, has a higher percentage of black people playing hockey than Hollywood does directing or writing movies. Not to mention when black people get an opportunity on camera, the roles presented to them are a little limited.
The only role they gonna let us do is a slave.
And the Oscar goes to 12 Years a Slave.
A butler.
I'm Cecil Gaines. I'm the new butler.
Or some street hood or something.
I'm a gangster, Grandpa, and I'm proud of it.
See what I mean? Now you might be thinking, why exactly is the film industry like this? I was thinking the same thing.
Hollywood is very conservative. That's why you keep seeing 30 reboots of Batman and Superman and Spider-Man, because they would rather go with something that's been tested than try something new, even though they depend on something new to keep people interested.
That's Catherine Squires, a professor here at the University of Minnesota that specializes in race and the media.
You know, we have a reboot of Star Trek and a reboot of Star Wars, and we have, you know, characters from various Marvel comics that keep coming out, right? And since all of those characters are white, right, that means that even when you remake something, you still have smaller possibilities. So that conservative impulse further undermines the position of people of color who are trying to break into the business.
And unfortunately, Hollywood didn't just get like this overnight.
Hollywood and TV have done this for years. They've capitulated to racist fans. Whether they were worried that movie theaters in the South wouldn't play something that had Sidney Poitier in it or what have you, they've capitulated to that. And so even though the audience is much more diverse and more global, there's a lot of research that shows that the people who are making these decisions are still assuming that there's going to be this kind of racist backlash. So the way they calculate these things is always on the very conservative side, and that's a problem.
How come the only black movies Hollywood wants to make are ones with black mammies in fat suits?
Yeah. Or black women in pain, man.
So basically, we got black people dying in the past and black people dying in the present.
That was a clip from Dear White People, a satire about the black experience at a majority white college that is a little bit too relatable to my life right now. The film, which was shot here at the University of Minnesota, by the way, was written and directed by a black man named Justin Simeon and contained a majority black cast, a rarity in Hollywood in 2014. I got a chance to talk with Marquis Thompson and Brandon P. Bell, two actors from the film, on their experience as black actors in Hollywood.
Do you guys feel like you ever get like sought out or casted in specific roles that are traditionally only for black people?
I mean, me personally, like, no. In terms of, yeah. I mean, if you, you know, both of us, we go out for tons of stuff, different kinds of roles, and we haven't been, I don't feel like we've been placed into a box. And so
we're not that famous yet.
Despite all of the current racist trends of Hollywood, Brandon and Marquis just didn't seem to be affected. Brandon even went as far as to say,
I'd say there's benefits of being a black actor and there's not. I mean, at the same token, we've talked about this before. If you're a white guy in Hollywood, there's 9 trillion of you. Good luck. For minorities, you can almost name the actors by hand. It's almost more advantageous to be an African American because there are opportunities.
Well, that's great, right? Maybe things aren't quite as bad as we thought they were. But other black creatives don't feel quite as rosy about the state of the industry.
Unfortunately, there's not a whole lot of balance when it comes to our content. Like, when I say our content, man, like, you look at, like, most of the content or stories or shows and movies that are about black characters, there's not a lot of range, meaning you don't see, like, a Harry Potter in the hood.
That's Carl Jones, the head writer, director, and animator of Adult Swim's Black Dynamite, an animated parody on the blaxploitation genre set in the 70s about a bad mother shut your mouth named Black Dynamite that fights the man and the powers that be.
I just got one thing to lay on you cats and then I'll split. That I am declaring war on anybody who sells drugs in our community.
But Black Dynamite, I sell drugs in the community.
Carl talked to me about the unique pressures he faces being a black creative behind the camera.
All the responsibility and the pressure falls on the one show that does have a platform where they can be critical on black people. They also are held to a certain standard, and people expect you to show all different sides. You know, and you may not be able to do that.
We would never, ever say to a white middle-class man that he's not doing a good job of presenting all of the different variations of white middle-class life. Woody Allen can tell all the stories about New York that he wants, but he's telling a story about 6 blocks of New York, rich white people who live on the Upper East Side. But people talk about his stories as having a universal appeal. But when Spike Lee makes a movie about 6 blocks in Brooklyn, people expect him to, like, solve the race problem.
Unfortunately, we won't be able to solve the race problem here either, but that doesn't mean that it's impossible. As you can see, just from the small sample of people that I talked to, this issue is incredibly complex. Despite their differing views on the industry, Catherine, Carl, Brandon, and Marquis all agreed that not only do we need black people telling black stories, but we need intelligent people telling a diverse range of stories in general. So here's to hoping that Hollywood catches up with the times a little bit and starts seeing the world in a little bit of color. And if not, there's always Black Acting School.
Black Acting School!
For Culture Q, I'm Max Fuller.
In studio, I have with me
Aaron Bolton,
Marjorie Otto,
Max Fuller,
and today we're going to talk about a story. It's going to have a good time, and yeah, see how this goes.
Did you expect some of those answers you got from, like, the people from Dear White People?
No, not really. They were, like, actually really just optimistic, and I don't know, maybe just because they're young in the industry, but, like, they just seemed really, like, they didn't seem like racism or, like, all the stuff that I was reading about in the book. And hearing from professors, like, hearing it from them themselves, they're like, it doesn't really feel like that.
Do you think that's just, like, maybe older actors face that more than, like, younger actors then?
I feel like, yeah. And it just maybe
depends on, like, if you're like Denzel Washington, you've probably tried out for so many different things, yeah. You know, like eventually along the spectrum.
But once you're at like the level of Denzel Washington, like it really doesn't matter anymore. You can kind of do anything.
That's true.
He can roll planes and be an alcoholic at the same time. It all works out for Denzel Washington.
Yeah, I feel like there's like a huge pyramid, you know, and Denzel's at the top and then everyone else is just stuck doing like typical minority roles.
There's like such a small sample of black people that like they just get recycled and reused through all the different things. Yeah. It's like, wow, I just really want to see a different black person. Samuel Jackson's cool, but he's been yelling at me for like 13 years now. So.
Like a black movie gets made, like does it appeal to white people? Like, or does it just stay within like only the black community is going to be paying attention to like something like that?
Well, that's the thing. One of the interesting things that I learned that I never really thought of when I was interviewing these people is that the critics actually have like a lot of influence on that. And the critics can like shape a movie to make it seem like it's just a black movie instead of like a movie with black people, like for everyone. Because like it's not, you wouldn't just call a movie, a regular movie, like a white movie.
Mm-hmm.
So, but like some movies get labeled as a black movie just because they have a majority black cast. So like the critics really have like a job, and lots of critics don't even go to black movies and like pay attention to them, so that like also they don't get enough shine and like as much attention as other movies.
I mean, I guess like as just your typical trillion in one white man, like I don't like see those things. Like if it's like something that I don't feel like I'm not gonna understand, like I just it just kind of glazes over for me.
Yeah, no, so. That's how I feel about everything, though. Like, I just went to a movie called Dope that just came out.
And how was that? Yeah.
It was really good, actually, but I was, like, the only person in the theater. Like, really? Nobody else was in the theater.
That's a black movie, right?
Like, yeah, it's, like, it's so annoying. And, like, all the black movies have to be about struggle. Like, there's never... When do you ever see a black movie where black people are just happy? Like, hey, man, we're just black in America, and it's cool. So I was like, man, my feet is so tired, Lord. I've been working all night and all day just to feed my children these crumbs. It's like, oh, come on.
I mean, like, the last question I probably want to ask is, like, what stories you want to see in a black movie?
I just want to see, like, that's why I liked Dope so much. Is like, I want to see, it was about kids that are, like, more like me, not just, like, stereotypical black kids. Like, I listened to rap music and play basketball, but I also watch anime and, like, read Ernest Hemingway and Shakespeare and stuff like that. So I just want to see, like, a more well-rounded like black story, and it just no more struggle.
Okay,
we can be happy. I mean, the struggle is in real life, so let's go to the movies and escape the struggle and then come out of the movies and then deal with all the
Margie, do you want to go next?
I was gonna do my cat show story.
Okay, great. Let's check it out. The phrase cat show may lead someone to think of the stereotypical crazy cat person. In her story, Marjorie Otto shows that cat shows can be something of an educational experience, bringing out the crazy cat person in all of us.
On a warm spring day in April, the Hopkins Pavilion was buzzing. It was the 92nd and 93rd annual cat shows sponsored by the Gopher State Cat Club, a member of the American Cat Fanciers Association. As you walk into the show, you are faced with rows upon rows of cats. Off to the right are 5 judging rings. I went to ring 3 and watched Judge Deb Witch judge kittens.
This is a Singapura kitten. They are our smallest breed of cat. They only come in one color. This is called Sepia Agouti. It's basically a ticked tabby pattern. So each little hair has little bands of color that give it this cool kind of shaded look. Little old muslin tummies. Yes. They have kind of a broad rounded wedge to their head, big, beautiful, rounded eyes, short little muzzle, nice big cupped forward ears.
Deb has been an ACFA judge for 15 years. She explained that many owners show kittens in order to decide whether to show them as adults. When judging kittens or cats, Deb is looking to see if these kittens fit the standards set for each breed. She might judge the shape of their ears, the size of their face, the proportion of their back legs to their front legs. She's also looking to feel if the cat is skinny or too fat, and also looking at the quality of the cat's fur. Showing a cat isn't just about the two-day event. There's a lot that goes into prepping a cat for the show. It's a year-long process. There's constant grooming, specific diets, and desensitizing it to large groups of people.
My name is Ben Tatro. I show cats.
I spoke with Ben to see what he and his wife do to get their cats ready for a cat show. Ben and his wife have been showing cats for about 2 years now. And what goes into getting ready for a cat show?
A lot of grooming. Like I said, my wife's a groomer. So she, throughout, I mean, even when we don't have a show to prep for, she's always taking well good care of the cats, making sure they get bathed and groomed and all that. And then last week before the actual show, she's constantly bringing them to the salon, constantly grooming them, making sure that they smell nice and pretty, that everything's good. And then the day of the show, just making sure we have, you know, all the combs, all the brushes, all the dry shampoo, all the stuff that we need when we're there to make sure that they stay in that good condition throughout the show, because there's a lot of people who they like to touch the cats, they like to play with the cats, and obviously that makes them a little bit dirty, so you gotta clean them up throughout the show. But yeah, a lot of grooming before and during.
Ben and his wife show three cats:
Annabelle, Minnie, and Sassy Pants. They're just regular domestic cats. Minnie's Persian mixed with who knows what, and Annabelle's just a barn cat, and Sassy Pants is also a barn cat. So we show in the household division. Any cats allowed. They don't have to be any specific breed. This last show we had a cat who only had three paws. That was not held against the cat at all. The cat was still spunky. The cat still got a couple of ribbons. So yeah, it's just for any cat.
Ben explained that judges are looking for healthy cats. They don't want them to be too skinny or too fat. They should have really healthy, clean coats. He said especially no dander. That's a big one. And that the cats have a really good personality. He said that they don't necessarily have to play with toys. For example, they have an older cat that's about 8 years old that they don't expect to play with toys, so that's not something that's held against them. But just that they're not crabby or mean or hissing at the judges.
Yeah, and then there's also a huge part is the judge's choice. It's kind of a free-for-all that you'll get the judges that like male cats. So they're top 10, all male. You'll get the judges that like black and white cats. So all top 10, black and white cats. It's kind of the belly of the beast there. When you're in a division that doesn't really have a set category, there's, as long as your cat is groomed well, is friendly, and is fed well, you have as best a shot as anybody.
What's your favorite part about showing cats?
Everyone there is so friendly, even though even though you're with your competition. Your competition's sitting right next to you. You're seeing what they're doing. Their cat looks amazing. Your cat looks absolutely amazing too. It's all a lot of fun. And it's everyone's there for each other, supporting each other. No one's there trying to beat each other out, even though, yes, you're in a competition, but at the same point, there's a big sense of we're all crazy cat people, and it's fun to be around a whole bunch of crazy cat people.
For Culture Q, I'm Marjorie Otto.
All right, hello.
All right.
How you guys doing?
So how was the cat scene?
It's pretty interesting. I found it to be a lot more diverse than I was expecting. Like, age-wise, there were little kids there, high schoolers, college students, all the way up to super old people. So I was kind of surprised by that. And that it isn't as competitive as I was expecting. Everybody was really nice to each other and sharing cat tips, I guess. Like,
it is really worth thinking about the people that go and the culture surrounding it, rather than just like the cats themselves. And you're like, what's going on? You know what I mean? Like, this is just a culture in itself.
Really. It's kind of like how we have such a crazy cat community on the internet. Like, everybody's so into cat. Like, we have cat video festivals in the summer to watch cat videos. I mean, it's kind of the same thing. People just go there and they always ask, oh, can I pet your cat, blah, blah, blah. Or if somebody has kittens, oh, how much are the kittens? I really want one. It's just this societal obsession, I guess, with cats.
Oh my. All right, Aaron, you're up.
The security breach one.
Oh yeah, that's a classic.
Yep, classic.
Cool, man. Let's do it. Over the past 20 years, computers have become a widely used part of daily life. They allow you to stay in touch, get work done, and information is always at your fingertips. But as we invite this technology into our lives, we also invite the issues that come with it. Cybersecurity being the biggest among them, we not only need to learn how we can prevent privacy issues, but to prepare ourselves when a break-in happens. Reporter Aaron Bolton has the story.
Tonight, new concern about a security breach, this time at Home Depot.
Target hit with a huge security breach.
The word security breach. It has become part of our vocabulary over the past few years in light of large-scale attacks on corporations. They are described as
alarming security breach.
Massive security breach.
The largest cyber attacks in U.S. history.
And it could be bigger than the breach at Target.
They may make you nervous about your personal information, but it can be easy to forget about the variety of techniques hackers ploy to wage cyber warfare one person at a time. The person behind the other screen may not be stealing your identity, but instead wants you to pay them using
a fairly new thing that's occurring in our environment.
This is Brian DeLynn, Chief Information Officer at the University of Minnesota, and he's talking about computer hijacking.
You hear it called things like crypto locker and stuff. Basically, it's somebody has some piece of malware that encrypts the drive and makes it unreadable, unless you have the key.
The primary target of an attack like this isn't your personal information, it's your money.
A banner came across, and it was not a GUI interface. It was like the old machine language, I guess you'd call it. It just said that if you want these files to open up, you must pay $1,000, and it gave some instructions on how to transfer money to this place. My name is Raleigh Mattson. I'm a 61-year-old male who looks much older than that.
Mattson is a sales representative for a large computer distributor who works from home. And his work computer was hijacked a few months ago.
Did you lose all your files, or are your files stored on the cloud storage?
I didn't think it was necessary for me because I'm that clever. So I lost everything except for in my email things. You know, there are things that the company backs up, but the personal files, they were just gone.
Madsen has seen just about every major change in the computer industry.
I have known since day one to back things up. I sell computers every day for 40 years. I tell people one thing, back up your stuff.
How someone like him can get put into a position like this, it's hard to pinpoint.
I said yes to somebody. I accepted something. You know, I probably get in a day, business-related, specific to me, 200 emails. You know, I'm copied on things, that kind of thing. If you catch 5,000 of your emails, no problem. But the 5,000 first is a problem. That's what it is.
Okay, so far you've heard terms like encrypt, virus, and malware. To make this straightforward, here's how it goes. The hacker attaches malicious software, known as malware, to link generally sent through email. So for someone like Madsen, who gets 200 emails a day, it can be difficult to always have your guard up. The victim clicks on the link, and the malware is installed onto the device. The malware then has the ability to lock up your hard drive, the piece of hardware that stores all your information on your computer.
If you spam a million people, some insignificant small part are gonna send the money back, because it costs nothing to spam 100 people is no less than spamming 100 million people. It's a pretty ingenious thing to do, and most of it begins with a belief in Russia.
It can be easy to think of the person on the other side as this sophisticated hacker across the world, but Madsen cyber attacker could have been his next-door neighbor using malware purchased off the internet.
They're just using malware that's out there, that's available. They're not often creating it themselves. They're buying something.
And these pieces of software don't always do the same thing.
It all depends on the type of malware that they've put involved, and the ones that you were describing earlier.
I had explained to him earlier what had happened in Madsen's case.
Generally the ones that they're completely locking the entire drive versus they may be locking some piece of information instead. But it all depends on the malware that they've used.
Because there's such a variety of malware used, it makes it even harder to understand how it happened to you. Some forms of malware give its user the ability to launch their attack at a time they choose. So if you clicked on the link 2 months ago, you may not even remember it.
It could be months, it could be a year, it could be, you know, a long time.
Once it's happened, there's not a whole lot you can do. And as for Madsen's computer?
I sent it back and it was destroyed. They didn't want to take the risk of looking at the drive and that thing. They just destroyed it.
Dylan says the best thing you can do to fight computer hijacking is to back your stuff up to a place not connected to your computer.
I don't fear it. I mean, it's a fact of life. I mean, I guess you could worry about everything. Unless you go off the grid and turn your machine off, you're open to that.
As computers continue to creep into our lives, so do the issues they bring with them. It's Murphy's Law. If it can go wrong, it will. For Culture Q, I'm Aaron Bolton.
Hello, Aaron Bolton. How you doing, mate?
Great.
Cool, man. We just heard your story. It was pretty
good. Yeah, it wasn't quite as entertaining as everyone else as far as like the laugh factor. I don't know. When I initially heard about this story, I was told that it was like the whole office that got hit. So I was like super excited to like go in there, and I was like hoping to find like all these people that are pissed off that like your whole business is like ruined. And then I like unfortunately found it was just like one guy. So, I mean...
Well, he sounded pretty miffed. So
yeah, well, bummer for him because he lost, like, all his family pictures and, like, because he used his work computer as his personal computer, too. So he lost, like, all his family photos from, like, the last, like, 4 years.
Oh, my God.
And so, like, his family photos have been, like, are just gone. Like, there's, like, he has, like, 5 that he saved in another place, and, like, that's it, so...
Well, do the Russians have them? Are they, like, looking at them?
Yeah, his family.
And I was like, oh, so, like... Besides your like family photos, like your last 5 years of your family's life being erased, like is this like how else has this been devastating? And he was just like, "Oh, they sent me a new computer this morning," and like that was it.
Didn't care.
It was just
you got to admire the calmness. You know, I think you can really set an example for everyone. If it does happen to you, just be chill.
Well, it'll be fine. If your family gets erased, just be chill about it too.
And the really ironic thing is, he's sold computers for like the last like 30 years. And so he tells people all the time, he's like, gives the advice, like, back up your stuff because, like, it'll happen to you. And, like, he didn't back up his stuff.
And it totally happened to him. Oh, my goodness.
So, yeah, this guy, it's not like he didn't know. I mean, he's very, very aware of what could happen, and it totally did.
All right, that was a sad story, but definitely an important lesson to learn. Thank you so much, Aaron. And that concludes this week's Real College Podcast, online and on air, helping you discover the Twin Cities. I've been joined by
Aaron Bolton,
Marjorie Otto,
Max Fuller,
aka Fidel Maxtro.
Thanks, man.
Thank you.
And our advisor is Cyril Manchek, and I am your host, Matthew Curtis. You can listen online at RadioK.org and iTunes, or on Sundays at 6 p.m. on Radio K. Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Culture Heritage Fund, and thank you for listening. Sweet parents, oh, who sleep apart.